Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. One of the great human rights atrocities in history, Chinese political prisoners are tissue-typed and later murdered and harvested to supply the country's thriving organ transplant black market. How long have the regime's enemies been so targeted? And how does the system work? For years, that has been difficult to discern fully. China is one of the world's most secretive societies, and unequivocal answers have proved elusive. Until now. My guest, Jan Jukalik, has written a crucial book, Kill to Order, China's Organ Harvesting Industry and the True Nature of America's Biggest Adversary, in which he explains in detail how the organ harvesting system operates, who benefits, and what can be done about it. Jukalik is a senior editor with the Epoch Times and host of the popular video podcast, American Thought Leaders. His career has spanned academia, international human rights work, and now for almost two decades, media. He's interviewed nearly 1,000 thought leaders on camera and specializes in long-form discussions challenging the grand narratives of our times. He's also an award-winning documentary filmmaker, and he's my friend. Jan, welcome to Humanize.
Wesley, it's so awesome to be here with you.
How did you get into media, and what attracted you to that career?
You know, it really started with human rights work. I had committed myself to exposing, a horrible persecution that I was seeing in communist China of Falun Gong practitioners starting in 1999. And this was, you know, kind of an astonishing thing. I was kind of new into the space, and I had discovered basically that people were being killed in China's vast incarceration system for, basically refusing to sign a piece of paper that said, I will give up my beliefs. And, you know, and that just, it was just not something that is easy to fathom. And it spoke of a really monstrous regime doing horrible things to its own people. And, I started by, I actually worked on the nonprofit side of the UN, providing torture reports. This was devastating to do, by the way. Like, I was always a good writer, but I would be given these reports. You know, you've got very detailed information about where, who's doing it, the horrible things that are being done to this person to break them. And we would write those up for the UN Human Rights Commission Special Mechanisms, Special Rapporteur on Torture and others. And then they actually could do these interventions that might help save a life. It was an interesting time. But with time, I also got a little bit despondent because I saw that the UN system appeared to be stacked towards the perpetrators, towards people trying to actually advocate for human rights. And so I ended up doing direct work on this underground railroad that was going from bringing a religious prisoners of conscience or former prisoners of conscience that got out through the Golden Triangle from China into Bangkok, where they could get some protections, okay, and possibly get resettled as UN refugees to third countries that were taking them. So in this process, I discovered, I was just thinking about this a lot, and some of these people had unbelievable stories to tell. Unbelievable, both just, astonishing what they went through, but also like the conviction they had. And I wanted to tell these stories. And it turned out that so many media didn't really want the stories. You know, there was this, you mentioned at the beginning that I'm interested in breaking some of these grand narratives. The massive, you know, I call it a 95-5 narrative back in those days in the 2000s was that China was going to liberalize, that China was going to become a Taiwan or a South Korea, as long as we pump enough cash in there. And by the way, there's this big market that you're going to get, right? And just like everybody really believed this. I mean, there's people that really think very differently today that deeply believe this, but I knew, right, that they were violating the core. You know, there's a reason that it's the First Amendment in America and the Bill of Rights, right? The First Amendment is freedom of speech, freedom of belief, freedom of conscience, freedom of assembly, these things, right? If those things are being violated to the point of death, if people are being killed for basically trying to exercise those rights, that's not a liberalizing society.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I was already challenging this grand narrative that at that time it was unbelievable. No one wanted to listen. And then I kind of came upon Epoch Times, which was the opposite story. They wanted everything I was doing.
That gets me to my next question. Tell me about the Epoch Times for those who do not know it. Is it a newspaper, which I know it is, and also it's online. Tell us about the work of the Epoch Times.
So the Epoch Times was born at Georgia Tech in Atlanta, and it was students. It was actually a student media that was created in 1999 in response to Jiang Zemin, who was the dictator of China at the time, starting to persecute Falun Gong practitioners and push out like massive, incessant, dehumanizing propaganda to demonize these people. And this is sort of, you know, as I know you've actually explored this before in your work, Wesley. It's kind of a prelude to atrocity, this kind of dehumanizing rhetoric against groups. And communist societies specialize in doing this. Okay, there's always some group that's being targeted in this way. In China, the landowners were one of the early groups targeted because they wanted to seize their land. You know, we have this quirk in our psychology that when we start believing, because of mass propaganda, that people are lesser than us or dangerous or something like that, that lets us tolerate horrible things being done to them and maybe even participating in that.
In China, you had the Cultural Revolution.
Cite this example. There was this Netflix series last year that I ended up watching called The Three Body Problem. And at the first episode, it just completely blew. This is what hooked me on the series, right? It was a kind of this weird sci-fi series. But they had a really accurate portrayal of the Cultural Revolution at the beginning. I mean, shockingly, right? They were re-educate, basically, he was a scientist and he refused to submit, right? It killed him in the process, right? And this is essentially the same sort of process was happening to Falun Gong practitioners in time, where they were told, renounce your faith, renounce your belief, or pay the ultimate price. There's this unwritten rule in the incarceration system that Falun Gong deaths would be considered suicides. They could work on these people basically to whatever end. Was started at Georgia Tech by people. Some of them actually had gone through the student movement in 89, had left China, got out, and just never went back and had that experience. And some of them were Falun Gong practitioners, and they just saw crazy false narrative being pushed massively through the population, and they wanted to do something about it in a country that did have the First Amendment. Okay. And so that it was born as this student website. Thankfully, there were a lot of great tech people among them, because the website exploded, became viral. It was in Chinese language, by the way. And the regime wanted to get rid of it, of course, very quickly, because it was, again, counter narrative to what everyone was supposed to believe. But it also made it more popular. They were able to protect it. Pretty soon, there was a new physical newspaper in Chinese. 3 years later, there was an English edition focused a bit on China. That evolved a little further and soon became a kind of a general interest newspaper. We had a very popular, what you would call, evidence-based alternative health section that started with traditional Chinese medicine. Again, you know, sort of with that inspiration from Chinese tradition. But ultimately, I'd say in the last 10 years, the English edition kind of eclipsed the Chinese one. It's actually in 22 languages around the world and became an entirely general interest newspaper that's been that way for a while, but that with a bit of a focus on China, because we have this unusual network of insider sources inside China from which we get a lot of good information. And I think the critical part is that we were sort of founded to challenge big narratives that obviously are false, but somehow we're supposed to believe them. This became a much bigger thing in later years, strangely, to our own shock. And we found ourselves in these situations where we have to, you know, challenge narratives that people very vociferously believe in. And, you know, we've kind of been attacked as a result a bit on a whole bunch of issues. Yeah.
It's been very interesting to watch your competitors, media competitors like the New York Times and I think NBC, actually attack the Epoch Times. It's been quite remarkable to watch, and the attempt to kind of hold the Epoch Times down clearly hasn't worked.
No, and I mean, today we're, by paid subscribers, the number four media in America, you know, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, number two, Washington Post. I mean, it's been number three for a while. I think safely we're number four, but we might even be sort of, you know, really on their tails, because I know that they've been having a lot of trouble. What we do is really not that complicated. It's really being truth-seeking media. I'm not saying we get it right all the time. Sometimes we issue corrections as well, of course, right? The question is, are you actually trying to find out what's going on? Unfortunately, many media, in my view, in my estimation, and I think this can be shown empirically, do a different kind of journalism, which is more what they call, I think what the dean of the Columbia journalism school called activist journalism, where there's sort of a preconceived narrative that the stories are kind of built to reinforce. And that, you know, I think that's terrible, because I think that a lot of people didn't get the memo. Like, it's one thing if you tell people, I'm going to tell you only things that conform to the particular narrative that I want you to believe. It's another thing if you tell people, you know, I'm telling you the truth. I'm doing this truth-seeking journalism, but in reality, you're doing something very different. And I think just a lot of people right now are being bamboozled, frankly, with this glow, the glow of remnant glow of the legacy media that no longer are doing proper journalism.
I want to get into your book while we still have time, but I do have to ask, what are the Falun Gong? I mean, what is the belief system? Is it like a Buddhist system, or was it, and what was it that upset the Chinese government so much about it?
It's a fascinating ancient practice that's, you know, thousands of years old, quite possibly older than many religions that we're familiar with. It was passed down, as I understand it, you know, in a single lineage for a long time. And there are many such systems. So most of us would never know about them, because they're just kind of passed from one teacher, becomes a master, passes it to one or a few people, and it just keeps going like that, right? Falun Gong was popularized by a man named Li Hongzhi, who's considered the founder or the teacher or the master. Some people in the West don't like this term master, but it's really kind of the master of the system, so to speak, and popularized in the early 90s to a large, broader audience. He actually taught for a couple of years in a kind of a lecture format. People would come to auditoriums and he would teach this practice based on truthfulness, compassion, and forbearance. These are the core principles that people that do this practice try to live. What's really interesting about Falun Gong is that there's a lot of voluminous teachings. He's written a lot about this idea and how the system works and what it means. But there aren't a lot of what you would call rules. And I'll explain what I mean by this in a moment, right? The rules would be something that every Falun Gong practitioner kind of, because one of the rules is that the impetus is on you to understand the teachings and figure out how to implement them. Okay. Even if you were a practitioner and I wanted to kind of just emulate you, I would just copy you because you're so great at truthfulness, compassion, tolerance. I'm not allowed to do that. At least that's how I read the teachings, right? I have to really kind of understand them my own way and figure out how to live them, that the impetus is on me. And indeed, in this sense, there's no roster, like there's no joining. What makes you a Falun Gong practitioner is living the teachings, not joining some kind of a group. There's no treasury. You're not allowed to enrich yourself from it, okay? There's no worship of the teacher or the master or something like this. It's very, very self-directed, very grassroots, okay? There's no hierarchy. There's no leaders, really, actually. What's really interesting, right? And it occurred to me only maybe 15 years after kind of being in this space and reporting on it. And I think that if you were to design a system that could kind of resist totalitarian rule, it might look something like this, because it's very unusually self-directive, and there's no one to kind of, there's no sort of centralized authority to kind of get rid of to stop everyone from doing it or something like that. Everyone is really, it's about as grassroots as you can possibly get, I think. I mean, as so far as there's a sort of a central vision or teachings that guide the people.
And there are exercises also, as I understand it. A lot of people might be more familiar with Tai Chi, but it's kind of like a Tai Chi kind of exercises that are involved.
100%. And so visibly, people would notice that there's these slow moving exercises and a sitting meditation that people do that would look a bit like maybe a yoga type meditation. So these are viewed as supplemental to the living the teaching. So an important part indeed of the system, but not, it's not that valuable as I read the teachings, right? To just do the exercises, because really the exercises just support being able to live truthfulness, compassion, and tolerance. And that's what actually yields the health benefits. Because one of the reasons Falun Gong spread so quickly in China in this sort of grassroots, I mentioned that Li Hongzhi taught for 2 years, right? He'd been 92 to 94. And after that, he just said, look, if you like this, I mean, I'm paraphrasing here just to be clear, right? But share it with people, right? But never coerce. That's, by the way, another rule would be that you can never coerce someone to believe this or anything else for that matter. It has to be volitional, right? Self-directed. So, and it just spread.
Just so we're clear, you're Falun Gong. You follow the teaching.
Yeah, no. So I actually had an amazing experience. This is actually what got me into China in the first place, right? Like I had basically in my previous career, I got very sick. I worked overseas. I worked in Madagascar actually, and I got sick with what was ostensibly an incurable disease. And someone recommended as an alternative health method, the Falun Gong exercises. I learned them and I just felt better. And in a couple of months, basically my neurologist cleared me. She said I was in full remission and, you know, keep doing what you're doing, but don't, you know, you don't need to see me anymore. I don't know what to tell you. And so, and in that, I also had kind of I felt like I needed to, basically do service in my life. And I felt like, and I met a woman who had actually been tortured in China specifically for not renouncing her faith. Like literally they gave her a piece of paper that said, I don't remember exactly, but these three statements she had to agree to, and they would have let her go, but instead they tortured her and she never broke. I found it very inspiring. And I also felt I should try to help these people. That's what got me into the human rights side in the first
place.
There's
a real parallel here with the early Christian church, the persecution that early Christians faced in terms of renouncing their faith or doing emperor worship and this kind of thing, and people being inspired by the martyrs actually being put to death rather than give up their faith. I'd love to talk more about that, but time means we have to move on, and I want to get into your book, Kill to Order. I've read your book, obviously, and I totally endorse it. If your allegations are true, and I'm really convinced they are, China is the moral equivalent of Nazi Germany. What kind of research did you conduct, and how much evidence that you present is verified and indisputable that China is literally, and let me be clear what we're talking about, arresting political prisoners, mainly Falun Gong, but also others, tissue typing them, and then when somebody comes to the black market to purchase a liver or a kidney or a heart, if they match the tissue, they're killed, they're harvested, and then that organ is sold to the recipient. Is that what's going on?
Yeah, no, exactly. The body of evidence has been gathered over 20 years. I did some of the original reporting on this. Just to be clear, this book, I bring together the work, the painstaking work of a small but really effective group of people, David Kilgore and David Matus, in the early years, a group called the World Organization to Investigate the Persecution of Falun Gong. They did a bunch of amazing work, literally calling hospitals and asking about transplants and getting shocking answers back, things like that. South Korean film crew that took an undercover camera in looking for organs in China, because that's a big market where South Koreans going to China to get organs. Ethan Gutman, who just has a new book that's just come out, The Xinjiang Procedure, on the focus of how this has added the Uyghur people to this kind of machine of death, whatever, however you want to construct it. I would love to explain to you exactly how it works. I think you got like 80% of it in your question, but I think it's important to specify, how is this different than like your garden variety, also horrible organ trafficking that happens in other parts of the world? Because indeed that exists as well.
Okay, go ahead.
But I bring together all of this, 20 years of research and so forth. And I do have a few contributions, but a lot of it is just work that didn't get its due back in the day because people were just simply not ready to accept it.
Yeah, I knew David Kilgore, who was a member of Parliament of Canada.
Yes.
And he was not Falun Gong. And he and Mattis really strived to bring this to light. I wrote about it when I heard about it, but people ignored it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And part of it, and I mean, I also argue that it's very difficult to believe. And yes, that's part of the challenge, right? Like, I had to be hit over the head with the evidence myself to really say, okay, yes, this is real. But this is how it works, okay? So you have to have the state actor, like the Chinese Communist Party. You have to have the dehumanizing propaganda, because for the reason that we just don't like to, as human beings, do bad things to people that are our neighbor. And we're talking about 1 in 13 Chinese at this point, by the way, that were Falun Gong practitioners in 1999, right? That's a lot of people.
That explains why they were threatened.
Well, yeah. One typical explanation for why Jiang Zemin began this persecution of Falun Gong practitioners is that there were more, by government estimate, than the Communist Party itself. There's also a good evidence that he was just an incredibly jealous person. And he was basically jealous of Li Hongzhi, who had the love of the people, something he could never have as the dictator. And I resisted believing this for a number of years, but just watching politics more over the last however many years, I'm beginning to think that that was actually a big reason, right? I never assumed world leaders made decisions based on such things, but I think they do, actually. So I think that was part of it. But part of it, just on that point, I think Falun Gong's unique just kind of anti-totalitarian structure, if you accept my premise with that, right? I think that itself almost is a kind of in itself a bit of an existential question for totalitarians, because if this is growing, right, and you have all these people that are free thinking in your system that demands obedience, demands your soul's, you know, your submission, or at least performatively, and really wants kind of your soul, so to speak, maybe someone figured it out. I don't know. But it took me years to figure that part. Anyway, but going back to this, when you both push this propaganda through the system and you incarcerate a massive group of people, which indeed they did with the Falun Gong, you can now blood type, tissue type, and organ scan them, okay, and create a database. So now when someone needs that organ, for example, pays as a transplant tourist, okay, the moment that transaction is made, the so-called donor, you don't have to wait for that catastrophic accident. You don't have to wait for the unique situation where all these matches happen and the accident happens, and then you get those people together really quickly because the person's going to expire and the circulation still needs to be happening to get that organ to not be rejected, right, by the body as it goes into the new body. It's rare. That's why people wait in civilized and ethical scenarios, right? But here you have a prisoner of conscience incarcerated, pre-matched, because there's so many of them, and that person can now be shipped and killed to order. And that's indeed why my book is called Killed to Order. This is unique in the world. We're not aware of any other scenario, because it takes this particular set of, it takes a totalitarian system, I think, and this unique set of circumstances where you can really incarcerate a large group of people and build this database.
And there's a lot of money. There's a lot of money in it.
Huge money. I mean, Ethan Gutman in 2016 or so, he testified in front of Congress that his numbers came, and this is the number we tend to use approximately for how many transplants, because it's compelling, 60 to 100,000 transplants per year. This is a wide boundary, okay? The error bars on this are big because it's hard to estimate, but this is a very conservative estimate in itself. Okay. And the reason I even say 60 to 90,000 myself, we kind of debate this with Ethan a little bit. Why don't you just use 60, 100,000? It just sounds a little smaller. And the problem was I always found that it's just so difficult to talk to people about this. People would literally leave the conversation mentally. And when you hear such numbers, what do you mean annually? How is it that we don't know about this? Right. And there'd be this kind of conversation. I wanted to be able to, you know, give someone something that is honest, right? But also doesn't freak them out to a level that they don't want to communicate anymore. So I think 60 to 90,000, 60 to 100,000, that's a credible number. And you can watch Ethan defend this under oath. And the problem, by the way, on this point, when it comes to the numbers, right? And that's how you get a $9 billion industry, by the way. Since you're asking about the financial incentives, the data is even less available since this China tribunal, which was this huge assessment of all the evidence, basically over the course of the better part of 2 years from late 2018 to 2020. This international tribunal run by Sir Geoffrey Nice.
And what did the tribunal include?
Well, the tribunal concluded within a few months of it that absolutely there's this industry happening. Absolutely, Falun Gong practitioners are likely the main source and that it's happening at significant scale. And then they had a final judgment, you know, almost 2 years later, where they really looked through the whole body of evidence. But they only, you know, within months, it was clear to them that this is absolutely happening. They just wanted to have a comprehensive view of all the evidence that they had by 2020. So it's quite the tome. There's all sorts of things in there. There's even a New York Times testimony of a New York Times journalist who found some very compelling things, was kind of basically, it seems like, was asked to stand down from it after publishing a few articles there.
Yeah, all the news that's fit to print, right? I think the thing that illustrates it most clearly is if you need a new kidney or a liver in an ethical system like in the United States, you may be on a waiting list for a year to 2 years. How long is a wait for an organ if somebody goes to China and buys one?
The way that you get a two-week wait time, is... One of the whistleblowers, I've heard as short as 3 days, and sometimes it's longer, but it just kind of depends. But the issue is, in a normal situation, as I mentioned earlier, someone has to have a catastrophic accident, car accident or motorcycle accident, typically. Okay. And they have to match you in these blood tissue size, right? And that's rare because we have kind of unique characteristics. Our bodies reject organs, basically, right? So how do you get it in 2 weeks? Scheduled, by the way, there's two elements to this whistleblower, that this patient of a heart transplant surgeon. So the guy basically went to China and got his heart scheduled in 2 weeks. And that we know two things from that. One is that you have to have a massive population that you already know they're blood type, tissue type, and so forth. So this is this incarcerated population that now has a database of their information. That's how you get to 2 weeks. But scheduled means that you know when someone's going to be dead to give that heart, basically, or nearly dead, right? And there's only one way you can know that is you're making them dead. So that one data point told us a lot, right? That there's a big system. And this actually, the head of the Israeli Transplant Association at one point, Yaakov Levy, was the heart transplant surgeon who, also a professor at Tel Aviv University, who campaigned to get some of the first laws to counter this passed in Israel, basically that Israeli, their health subsidy, socialized healthcare system would not pay for China transplants. This law he passed in 2008. But so this is another one of these sort of, you know, compelling pieces of evidence that got the researchers like David Kilgore and David Matus to look into all the possible lines of evidence and the research that was done. And then that started this whole kind of enterprise, which I detail in chapter 5 in the book, you know, kind of the body of evidence over time as that grew.
I think another indication is that the Chinese people themselves don't generally benefit from organ transplant medicine, and they often don't actually donate. So So you have kind of a two-tiered system, the Chinese population not getting organ transplants because there isn't a lot of it being done ethically, and then well-off people from all around the world flying in, knowing that someone's going to be murdered, because let's be clear what's going on, so that they can have an organ. That two-tiered system, as I see it, is that what you've also noticed?
Well, so I had this really, really kind of rude awakening, so to speak. Do you remember there was this hot mic moment with Xi Jinping, Vladimir Putin, and Kim Jong-un? This happened, I think, in September one evening. I know my phone was basically buzzing a lot. Okay, let's just say, because people know I'm into this issue. And so, I mean, I'll paraphrase what they were saying. He says to Putin, when we're 70, we're just babies. Okay, Putin says in response, through continual organ transplantation, perhaps we can achieve immortality. And then she says back to Putin, our target's 150 years. And that's a paraphrase, of course. But wow, did that ever, you know, sort of light bulb went off in my head. I had compartmentalized the what's called Project 981, the elite longevity project of the Chinese Communist Party. By some estimates, the Chinese super elites live 10 years longer. I don't know if that's true. I don't know. It might be a propaganda number to get people to participate. I don't, but it's definitely longer, perhaps 10 years longer. On the other hand, I knew about the transplantation, of course, of forced organ harvesting, but it didn't occur to me. So the moment I heard the concept, I knew that, of course, this, you know, death machine or murder for organs system, kill to order system is fueling that elite longevity project. And indeed, there was this anecdote that I was sent a while back, which was like an obituary of a state minister where someone, and this is very creepy, but someone was basically writing about how amazing it was that this person had multiple organs transplanted. And it just kind of all made sense. Yeah. Right. So you find these very weird anecdotes, so to speak, that kind of prove the point. And I just thought it was something odd and creepy, but then I've understood exactly what it had a lot more significance the moment I made that connection. So just to answer your question finally, the super elites have access to this system. I even think that it's a higher level of motivation. The financial motivation, if it's $9 billion, right, a year. That's pretty significant motivation to do this if you have no moral boundary whatsoever, which clearly they do not. But what is the motivation if you do have no moral boundary like that and you have unlimited access to organs for yourself and your family, just in perpetuity? Yeah. That's what they've created for themselves. Someone actually said, I was talking with them about this, and they said, what would that be worth? And they said, well, it would be worth everything, wouldn't it? If you're one of these types of people.
This is a twisted form of transhumanism is what you're discussing here. I've been really disturbed by the media's lack of true clarion reporting on this. I mean, they have stories from time to time, but you know that media can push things or they can just, okay, I see I reported it on page 8, but they have not pushed this. Can you imagine if an enemy of the media, the usual suspects such as Israel, were doing something like this, the talking would never stop? Or if Trump had actually proposed anything like this, this kind of awful, literally Holocaust type evil, there would never be an end to these stories. But there was a book that I'm furious about still. It came out in, I believe, 2009, called Larry's Kidney, by a author named Daryl Asa Rose, who wrote about going to China and buying a kidney for his cousin Larry. And he gets into some of the issues that you've discussed without judgment, it seemed to me. But the reviews of the book is what really drove me crazy. The New York Times, the Washington Post, it's a laugh fest. What fun. What an interesting adventure. We're talking about murdering somebody to give Larry a kidney. And the American media was going, oh, what fun. I almost lost my cool. In fact, I did, because I wrote quite a bit about that at the time. It just reflects the, I think, sometimes amorality of too many in the media today.
Well, it's just, think about it. It's astonishing. What an astonishing book. You know, I don't get to talk about that book. That's actually one of my pieces of evidence, right, that I cite. It's astonishing because it wasn't meant to be a piece of evidence. It meant to be a fun, you know, adventure in China when they realize in a comical way somehow that this kidney is coming from very ill-begotten places, right? And so, I mean, I don't even know what to say about this book exactly. And I wasn't aware of the reviews at the time, by the way. I just remembered it as I was writing. That's right. I remember like this book coming out and just being like, I don't know what to make of this. But however, this is a piece of evidence, right?
Rose was kind of eventually shamed into saying, well, I don't support murder for organs. Well, gee, that's nice. Your money did. And in any event, how have Western transplant societies, medical journals, and hospital systems unwittingly or even perhaps knowingly enabled China's transplant industry as you describe it?
Unfortunately, in too many ways. I have a whole chapter in my book about how the Chinese Communist Party is expert at making both its own population and us complicit with itself and its various crimes. And I think this is part of why we haven't said enough about it. I hope that's changing right now. Maybe this book will play a part in that. You know, first of all, we train transplant surgeons in China. Like, we train Chinese transplant surgeons here.
Yeah. Yeah.
We fund all sorts of research partnerships. You know, one of the compelling pieces of evidence is this paper in the American Journal of Transplantation from a few years back, where they found out of looking at about between 2,000 and 3,000 Chinese published peer-reviewed transplant literature papers, that 70 of them had clear violations of the dead donor rule written into those published, publicly available scientific methods. And that's astonishing, right? Because like that means that the way the person died was their organs being removed, right? And they've just publicly made that available to be seen because that's just how the system works over there. That's how I read that, right? They just forgot that that's something that's not acceptable in a normal situation. So when you have this kind of evidence, can you really be working? Can you be funding? Can you have these research partnerships? No, I think we should cut off. I think we should, you know, I really think we should stop any form of cooperation until an independent party, like a truly independent party, they submit themselves to the scrutiny and show that they've developed a new system. Because right now we have no evidence they have anything but this guild to order system. And when you build one of these, they built this massive bureaucracy between 2000 and 2005 mainly, but then grew it further. But there was this kind of geometric growth of the number of hospitals, like up to, when Ethan Gutman testified, it was, I think, 146 hospitals that were doing this, basically. And now it's actually more. Even though we have less data about the individual activity of each hospital, they've really taken that underground. There's more of them. So it just tells me that it's still growing.
Sure. You know, one Falun Gong victim of organ harvesting actually lived to tell the tale. What is his story?
That is an astonishing story. All these years that I've been looking at this issue, I mean, 20 years now, but when I first learned of him a few years ago, I just couldn't believe it almost, because likelihood, you know, imagine the crime scene, right? Like, it's an operating room, you're taking whatever organs you have this, in, you know, the person's is raw matter to be used, clearly, right? You're taking their organ and killing them in the process, usually, and then you can just dispose of the evidence, right? Burn the body. This is apparently how it's done. So again, it's just a very easy thing to not have a lot of evidence. But here he is, Cheng Peiming, missing part of his, you know, we did extensive body scans of him and he's missing part of his liver. It regenerated since, and he's missing part of his lung. Unclear why that was taken. Apparently unclear exactly what they were trying to do. Perhaps it was some kind of a scientific experiment. In those days, partial liver transplants were quite experimental still. This was in the mid-2000s that this happened to him. But basically the guy was, you know, again, a prisoner of conscience, and he wakes up one day, shackled to a bed, 14-inch gash in his side, and feeling horrible inside. And it was only much later that it dawned on him that he had been organ harvested. He didn't realize that that's what had happened initially.
How did he get out?
I guess one way I could describe it is there were multiple moments where he could have met his death. Okay. And you know, at one point he literally escaped from one of these prisons because they didn't think that he was mobile enough to do anything. And people just fell asleep on the job, right? There were multiple moments where it seemed like very touch and go and he survived, much like actually many Holocaust survivors' stories go, that they somehow make it to the end of the war after all of these near-death moments or making decisions that led them to live instead of going to death. That's his story kind of reads like that. And I know he's a very unusual guy.
Have you met him?
Yes, absolutely. He's very kind of philosophical and frankly, a bit difficult to interview. David Matus, who is a human rights lawyer, one of these original kind of hero investigators of this whole issue from years back, he did a very detailed interview of him to assess his own credibility, his story. Of course, I have interviewed him, but I didn't sit down for hours and hours. David Matus had done this, and I used some of his work to kind of build out more of the I actually asked. I have an episode about him, which includes David Matus being interviewed. And
this is on American Thought Leaders?
On American Thought Leaders. It's a great episode. We talk to former Assistant Secretary of State of Democracy, Rights, and Labor, Bob Destro, who had actually played a very significant role in rescuing him to America. We have Nina Shia from Hudson Institute, Religious Freedom, runs the Religious Freedom Center there, just kind of talking about different aspects of the case. And we have his own testimony in there. And one of these observations is, like, I actually asked Matus, why do you think they did this? Like, you know, because they took part of his liver and part of his lung. What do you think happened, right? And he said, well, you know, maybe it was some kind of experiment. But actually, Jan, you shouldn't be asking me. You should be asking them because they did it. So they're the ones who need to explain why they did it. I don't know. Right. But he's missing part of his liver and part of his lung. And it just kind of struck me as interesting because it's our mentality, even myself, who I'm deeply steeped in this issue. Right? I'm kind of like, well, why would they do this? Right.
Now, this gentleman was Falun Gong. Is that correct?
Yeah. He was a Falun Gong practitioner. He was in prison purely for his faith.
And at some point, part of his liver was taken and part of his lung. He wasn't killed, which is what normally would happen. But he was able to escape, made it to the West. Medical tests have verified that he suffered these body injuries. And he claims he didn't know what happened because he was put under, but he suspects, and it seems pretty clear, that he was part of that program either in an experimental way or only part of his liver was used because, you know, you can take part of a liver and it'll regenerate.
It's really the sort of independent experts that say that he was harvested in this way. He's a very unusual guy. He believes that now, of course, but initially he didn't know what had happened to him.
And who would want to think that somebody would treat you in that manner? I mean, it would just be horrific. I don't know how you'd sleep at night. Let's see what China is saying about this. Now, China obviously knows about these allegations. I know that they've denied it, or they said, well, we've outlawed the black market in organs in China, which still, as you pointed out, thousands and thousands a year. So what is China's position on this, or do they actually just kind of stonewall?
It took many years. They've flipped positions 99.99% of the time. They attack the messenger, meaning that they just sort of say you're evil and you hate China, or you're doing Falun Gong propaganda, or some other attack the messenger type approach. One thing they've never done is presented any credible evidence of ethical organ sourcing activity in China, like at all. You know, so let's look at the timeline. Okay. This starts in 2000. There's a very low level of a transplantation happening. We actually have a surgeon who admits to having killed a prisoner prior to the scaling. They incarcerate the million Falun Gong. They scale the system. They build 150 odd hospitals that are doing this transplantation. We hit that number of 60 to 90,000 a year, transplants a year. And now it just keeps kind of chugging along. And by 2014 and 2015, a few different things happen. It's 2016, okay? One is they add that no one really does much, to be frank. There's some international institutions that are kind of running cover for it, in effect. That's a whole different discussion. That they dehumanize another group of people, the Uyghurs, and they incarcerate millions of them. And the whole region is actually now run like a police state. And they start adding, they add them to this machine. Around the same time, roughly, they also say, so initially they denied using prisoners for organs. Later they say, but privately they say to people it's death row prisoners that are being used to explain how you can get these organs so quickly, right? That people are being killed on demand anyway, but it's okay because they're bad people that were on death row. That's what they tell people. Of course, the actual number of transplants is orders of magnitude greater than any the most aggressive estimates of death penalty. So that happens. But then around, I forget exactly the year, but around that same time, they say, they suddenly have a conference. They say, actually, we don't use prisoners anymore. They change their tune. Now we have a registry, a real registry. But then looking at the numbers, researchers found actually that the numbers in the registry are a perfect quadratic equation. They created false data and they didn't even do it particularly elegantly. And that's all we've got since. Okay, basically, and never ever providing any explanation for the transplant volumes. We have hospitals that would say, you know, one hospital was pretending to provide, to do a number of transplants that was comparable to one of the top American transplant centers. Okay, we did this expose at the Epoch Times in 2016, A Hospital Built for Murder, it's titled, you can look it up. But the reality was it looked like there were, I think, an order of magnitude more transplants, like just dramatically more transplants actually being done at this hospital when you broke it down than what they admitted to, because they didn't want to admit to numbers that would look suspicious. They just tried to get numbers that people would say, oh, yeah, that's reasonable. The U.S. hospital does this many or whatever, right? So it's just been this, you know, kind of hiding it, but not particularly well. And the worst part, you know, I was just talking with a Catholic podcaster about all this stuff, and he was mentioning how there was, you know, the Vatican got kind of co-opted in this whole thing, probably not volitionally, right, in the process, because they would have this, they had this big transplant conference in China, and in the Vatican, the representative came back saying, look, everything looks great. Similarly, the Vatican had a conference that I often cite, that had Chinese representatives. That actually became a bit of a scandal at the time and created negative press for them. But they're always looking for institutions. This is one way in which they allow for these types of systems to stay. They get institutions which have some kind of international validation or legitimacy to kind of say, yes, what you're doing is fine. That's the kind of their main approach. They don't actually provide evidence that would suggest that they have anything like a semblance of a ethical industry. There's no evidence. There's no line of evidence that shows that. Like, it's not for having lack of people trying. Like, people have tried to say, look, could this be ethical? Is there any way the reality that we're observing in China could be ethical? And the answer is absolutely not. It just doesn't exist.
And I think the reason for that, and the reason so much of the other tyranny in China is ignored, has to do with money. I mean, you've got the Uyghurs, as you mentioned, who are victims of genocide, which has been very well established. They're victims of genocide. You have slave labor. You have forced abortions. You have the put down of Tibet. You have the social credit system where people, if they go to church or make statements that the government doesn't like, might lose the ability to work. I mean, it really, and with the AI and the facial recognition and so forth, it really is the most effective tyranny, I think, perhaps in the history of the world. And it makes a lot of money for some very powerful people in the West. And I think that that's a reason why you don't see a lot of hue and cry of some of the worst human rights abuses, certainly in the 21st century. And the media complacency to me is just stunning. Do you have any theories about that?
I absolutely agree with you about the financial collusion, if you will, right? But there's kind of two things happening. One of them is people kind of willfully saying, okay, let's keep the money flowing, right? Some of it is just simply that when you have that financial relationship developed over a long period of time, and this is indeed the Chinese Communist Party's strategy, right? In part, it's easy for you to not want to notice the things where you have some kind of plausible deniability that would endanger your investment. We have that psychology. Mark Twain has a famous quote about this that I can never remember exactly, but it's very compelling. Okay. It's very easy. He always says it so ironically and wonderfully. So I think there's both things that are at play. When it comes to the media, it's not really terribly complicated in some ways, because to work in China is you have to make the deal with the devil, right? Like you need a visa. How do you get the visa? Well, they are make it extremely clear what is acceptable and what will, quote unquote, hurt the feelings of the Chinese people. That's how they decry. That's how they describe saying something that they wouldn't like or reporting in a way that they wouldn't like. So you learn to self-censor. They've trained the journalists incredibly well. You can even touch some areas which are a little bit touchy as long as you report them on them the right way, just to show, create a veneer of credibility. But when it comes to human rights stuff, if you have a presence in China, you're not reporting on it honestly. You're maybe reporting on it partially honestly. And I also, by the way, I sympathize to some extent because this is a hard question, right? How do you report? Well, what we do, because we report on all the things the regime least wants reported on, we have to have deep cover people. All our reporters were rolled up years ago, given long-term prison sentences. It was horrible. But you know, how do you do it? Well, it has to be underground. Do we have a very large network of sources now that, you know, and do it?
At the Epoch Times, you're talking.
Yeah, yeah. And we and it's people risk a lot to do that, to provide that information. But if you're like the typical media that has official correspondence, and I mean, I would hope that most people that are correspondents in China, it wouldn't hold it against me for saying this, because it's kind of obvious. So there's an amazing piece years ago that was written by Perry Link from the academic perspective. It's titled The Anaconda and the Chandelier. It's worth looking up, but he looks at China scholars and how they're effectively how they end up being co-opted, because you need to have access to your subject matter. And if you don't, like that they kind of make sure that you don't go certain places with your scholarship.
Your book is just being released, and I'm going to be very interested, and I'm going to be paying close attention to see if you get reviews and interviews with more mainstream organs, such as the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Los Angeles Times, or on some of the major cable television and network television news stations, because what you've written here is really crucial. And you talk, your subtitle talks about the nature of America's biggest adversary. So you're actually, through this organ atrocity, you are describing what we're up against. And I'm going to be very interested, and I'm going to pay attention. And I may write about it if they ghost you, because this is important. It's important to the future of the United States.
I completely agree, because we need to understand who we're dealing with. I'm not an isolationist. I believe that we do have to, quote unquote, engage with even our enemies, right? People who view us as their enemies, which the Chinese Communist Party certainly does. But we need to understand who we're dealing with and not pretend that we're dealing with a normal regime, that you can negotiate and that they do it in good faith, that they have, one of the big topics I cover is that they have a zero-sum mentality. They don't believe in win-win. Win-win for them is two wins for me, kind of thing. If you don't understand that, you're at a huge disadvantage if you're not using that as part of your decision-making and negotiation process and include that understanding. I'm writing this for all sorts of people, for typical Americans. The written book is actually written in a very, it's going to sound funny, but in a light way, I think. I don't know, you can probably comment on this better than I can, because I'm a little bit close to it.
But it's easy to follow. You're talking right. About it's very easy to follow. It's not deep in the sense of scholarly language. It's everyday people language.
Right. And that's the purpose, is to kind of broadly educate, broadly, get people interested in this. And, it's super interesting. But while I've been doing this, right at the front end of writing this book, I was invited to a Rotary Club event. And it turned out that the Rotary Club, it's a great service organization that I've worked with over years when I was running international youth programs and so forth, actually has created what they call a satellite club, which focuses exclusively on trying to end forced organ harvesting in China. Okay. And so like, it's astonishing. I've actually just become a Rotarian as of a few days ago, because I love what they're doing and I'm, you know, I want to support that effort. So it's just, my point is there's like this, there seems to be a shift in the consciousness, and perhaps I would really hope that some of these larger media who do have presences in China, who might be, you know, obviously would be worried about having their access restricted. I would just say, look, consider this. You know, the evidence is voluminous and clear. It's hard to see something when it's against your access interest, I suppose, in this situation. But I think, you know, it's important that we bring this to the fore, and we do it for the good of the country, to be perfectly honest. And I don't mean you have to review my book necessarily or talk to me, but just like cover this issue.
Yes.
Because it keeps going strong, and it's 15 years on the backs of Falun Gong. Now it's been going for at least 10 years, probably longer, on the backs of Uyghurs. And I'm seeing an uptick in dehumanizing language against Christians right now.
Yeah.
And you know, I've actually talked with a China human rights activist, prominent pastor, Bob Fu, from Midland, Texas, and China Aid. He escaped communist China. And he agrees with me. Like, for me, I saw it anecdotally. He says, no, we're seeing this, right? Like, we're seeing the Zion Church getting rolled up. We're seeing controls on the Catholic clergy, and we're seeing this rhetoric. And I'm just like, what with just two groups, or perhaps more, that we're just not entirely aware of, because it's very hard to do this research, right? So right. I just think it's very, I think that I'm encouraging, you know, in the vein of you saying that you're wondering if media that typically have ghosted this issue will cover it. I would hope they do, because the time is now, and I think that Americans will really want to know now, finally. And I've seen that shift too. I see people being able to grasp it. I see people being interested in it. You know, we just did our book launch at the Trump Kennedy Center last night, and you know, there were tornado warnings. So like, you know, government people were let go at 2 p.m. and we still got a pretty massive crowd. I do think there's a shift. And I do hope these big, you know, the legacy media and so forth that have these interests in China do cover this.
I'll believe it when I see it, but let's hope. We're just about out of time, but you do say something that I think needs to be addressed quickly, if you could. You've warned that the utilitarian bioethics from China, prioritizing, you know, the collective good over individual rights, is seeping into Western medicine. What do you mean by that? I mean, we're not going to start grabbing people and organ harvesting them.
No, but it's a way of viewing the world. And this is this is something I started thinking about during COVID. And this is, frankly, to be frank, I learned a lot from your book, okay, The Culture of Death, which I think, if I may say, is a seminal, foundational book for understanding a lot of these things. And I hope a lot of people go out and buy it if they haven't yet, right? That are your listeners, although I expect many will have. But in the West, we've observed, and indeed you have cataloged, the growth of what we call utilitarian bioethics. And that is in contrast to Hippocratic medicine, which is where you see, you know, the Hippocratic medicine, the innate dignity of the individual human person. From the doctor's perspective, you're looking at someone trying to see the totality of their person and their ailment in the context of the individual. And when you suggest an intervention, you want it to have the least possible harm for that person, if it's indeed needed at all. You're considering, your focus is on doing the best you can for this particular individual in their totality. The other side of that spectrum, that would be one side, right? The other side of it is utilitarian bioethics, the greatest good for the greatest number. I'm not going to be able to describe this as well as you can. However, what struck me, right, as I was thinking about utilitarian bioethics and this way of thinking, right, the idea is that if it can help the whole, right, it's okay to sacrifice a few for that benefit. The problem is if you're those people that are being sacrificed, it's not really good for you, obviously.
No, in utilitarianism, there's no human rights, actually.
No. But just on this point, right? I suddenly, as I was writing this book, I was like, wait a second. What did Stalin say? Stalin said, in order to make an omelet, you have to break a few eggs. And I was like, my God, that is the personification of utilitarian bioethics, right? And because in the communist system, the greatest good is the survival and supremacy of the Communist Party. And that's why you get atrocity. That's why the Chinese Communist Party is the biggest killer of human beings in the history of the world, probably. And why you get atrocity in every communist society, because that's the greatest good. And you got to break a few eggs, and it's a lot of eggs to achieve that, apparently.
And I would point out that here in the West, with regard to utilitarian bioethics and organ procurement, there are some, not all, certainly not a majority, I hope, but who are actually now advocating in the most respected medical and bioethics journals that where euthanasia is legal, that euthanasia be done by organ harvesting because it will protect the organs. So I think you're quite right to be alarmed that this kind of thinking, while not meant to be a means of oppression, but could certainly seep into Western medicine.
Well, and this is the problem. Like we believed, I was talking about this at the beginning, right? That China's going to liberalize. We were told this, right? We believed it in huge numbers. Everybody believed it, basically, at one point. We've shifted now. At least, you know, a sizable portion of the population realizes that China, under the Communist Party, views us as an enemy, that looks at us as kind of gullible, subvertible society or whatever. So we were going to change them, but the reality is it happened in the other direction, in this utilitarianism. Yeah. Of course, you've documented extremely well how it sort of appeared in our own journals of, both medicine, bioethics, and so forth. And you kind of look at its rise. But at the same time, you know, the people that are into this stuff are looking, hey, look what's happening over there in China. Like these guys really have, you know, complete control over their system, and look at the great things they can achieve. Like a lot of us bought into this idea, right? They're the best at propaganda that China, you know, would take your pick, you know, that China lifted millions out of poverty. I love that one, right? Because there's a kernel of truth to it. But the part that they don't say is that, yeah, after the Great Leap Forward, when they drove a significant portion of the population to cannibalism, literal eating their children, well-documented. People don't want to believe this. People don't want to know, but that's what they did. They created such a depth of hell for their own society. And yeah, of course they had to survive. For the Communist Party to survive, they had to lift the millions out of that, right? But it's, you know, there's 40% of the population below poverty line in a way that most Americans can't even conceive over there. For example, Taiwan has three times the per capita GDP than China when you actually look at it. But we don't think of Taiwan as being, you know, this great miracle or something like that. We think of China as being the great miracle economically. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is that they've changed us in this respect, and not for the good, not for the better, because this utilitarian way of thinking about human beings basically discounts the innate dignity of every human being. This is in the Hippocratic tradition and the Judeo-Christian tradition, and frankly, also in the Chinese tradition, especially in certain dynasties, but not in the communist tradition. It's like the opposite.
No. Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm sorry, we're out of time. The book is Kill to Order, China's Organ Harvesting Industry and the True Nature of America's Biggest Adversary. Jan Jakulek is the author, and he has just done a real service in writing this book. Thanks for being on. What next for you after this book?
Well, the big thing right now is I'm hoping that people basically get this book, share it with their friends, get it to libraries. Actually, the Amazon link is at killedtoorder.com. killedtoorder.com. And you know, I just that's the push right now. And because I feel like it's like a once in a lifetime thing in a way for me, because, you know, I've been looking at this issue for so long. I finally see an interest. We have legislation being crafted. Lawmakers, like literally days ago, we have a bipartisan piece of legislation, the Falun Gong and Victims of Forced Organ Harvesting Protection Act that was just launched. I mean, there's another piece of amazing legislation called the Stop Forced Organ Harvesting Act that was passed. You know, the House equivalent of that bill that I just mentioned was also passed. So two bills were passed in the House near unanimously. There's a whole momentum around this. So I want to I want to use this book as a vehicle to build that momentum and continue with it. Because it's, you know, sometimes you just get these moments in time where you can put a dent in a real, in this case, in a dent in a major atrocity that's happening in the world. We can at least end our own complicity to it in a whole variety of ways. I describe that in the book extensively, whether you're just want to join a Rotary Club or call a senator office or a bunch of senators' offices or whatever, or you're a federal lawmaker or a state lawmaker. There's a lot you can do right now. That's my big focus.
Well, I hope it succeeds. Jan, thank you for being on Humanize.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.